welcome to episode 5 of the GTT podcast. I'm your host, Dan Lowry, and today I'm interviewing an absolute legend of the Iron Game, Broderick Chavez, owner of Evil Genius Sports Performance. So, Broderick is an authority on all things bodybuilding, powerlifting, and strongman events. He's a very free thinker and likes to share his thoughts and ideas on all things weight training related. Many of his ideas and thoughts will mesh well with almost all dedicated iron goers. Some, however, will be a bit more rough-edged for the faint of heart, especially in today's episode. If you would like to follow more of his work, make sure you check out his website, which is teamevilgsp.com. Today, we will be talking everything performance enhancing, legal and not legal. This is a great episode. We've had lots of great feedback about the early release on this one already. So plug in those ears, sit back, or hit the pavement for a run and listen into the great man himself as he talks a very, very interesting topic. All right, welcome to the show. I'm here with Broderick Chavez, a.k.a. the Evil Genius. Broderick, why don't you tell us about why you were called the Evil Genius, my friend?
Honestly, at this point in my life, probably just because I have a shit temperament. But that's not actually the genesis of the story, but that's probably where it lies today, to be fair. But I don't know. What do you want me to go through? Just kind of a who I am, how I got here kind of gig?
Yeah, please, please.
All right. Well, I've done a number of podcasts recently and I've gone through this story. I've probably given a slightly different version of each, but the short answer is, I literally came from the womb with the idea and understanding that I was going to pursue strength sports and, you know, bodybuilding. It just was in me. It was a thing, literally, not exaggerating, quite literally, nearly every day after I learned to speak, I asked the adults around me if I was able to lift weights, and I was given no as the standard answer consistently until I was about 8 years old, which case I was given a small set of weights in the basement, and everything unfurled from there. I was given a gym membership to my first commercial gym on Christmas Day, 1981. I was 10 years old. And literally from that moment forward, you know, just no stops, all in on every front, partly because of my commitment to this and partly because I was a bit of a prodigy and I was an early intellect even then. I was able to, or lucky enough to, surround myself with some really good, intelligent, influential, and most importantly, honest people. And I got some good guidance. I became a national caliber powerlifter and bodybuilder nearly simultaneously in my teens. I had won a teenage national powerlifting championship. I had won some teenage bodybuilding titles. Went to the national level in bodybuilding. Went to the international level in powerlifting. Was a marginal student through high school, but had a high interest in the life sciences and science, chemistry, et cetera, simply because it played to what I wanted to do. So I was willing to pull my head out of my ass and pay attention. Did sufficiently well to get myself into college, into university. I collected a four-year degree in biology, a minor, which almost became a double major, but stayed a minor in analytical chemistry, all the while expanding my personal athletic prowess and slowly realizing over time that between my intellect, my ability to relay information fairly succinctly, just parlayed itself into kind of a coaching position that I didn't really seek out. It just kind of came upon me. And of course, as I got older, it became a bigger and bigger part of what I do. Along the way, I'm not doing justice to this story at all, but along the way, I've trained with some very high-level bodybuilders, some very high-level powerlifters. Worked with a number of pro bodybuilders, worked with athletes that have gone to the Olympic Games, and just kind of expanded myself into just what I am now. And then, as I said, I'm not doing justice to it. All the while, being an athlete, being immersed in you know, professional level sports, The drug thing was not a mystery, not an unknown to me. So I pursued it very hard, my understanding of it, my application on myself, and you know, people that sought that kind of information. And partly because of just personality defects and partly because of the unique environment I was in, I'm one of the few people that didn't cover it, didn't hide it, didn't, you know, keep it subterranean. So being one of the few, you know, kind of forward and vocal people, I became reasonably influential in that niche and kind of made my way from there.
Look, I think your explanation did plenty of justice, and you're one of the unique and rare individuals that I've ever met within the industry who have the credibility as a lifter or an athlete, but also as an academic. It's usually one or the other, and there is this massive disconnect. Now, you've touched on it already with the whole drug topic, and obviously the theme of this podcast episode is all about the truth of anabolic steroids. There's obviously a lot of rumor and innuendo that goes around within the gym scene, the fitness industry, the world of sport, as to what steroids are all about. But it's very rare that people get to hear from somebody like yourself who actually knows what they're talking about. So why don't we start off with, I suppose, an explanation in your words of what are steroids and where do they come from?
Okay. And before that, I want to actually say a kind of a bigger, broader statement is I'm completely happy and comfortable focusing on steroids. But the reality is sports pharmacopoeia today is much, much wider, much greater width and birth than steroids. Steroids is actually a little tiny sliver of all of the many pharmacological tools available to all of the many kinds of athletes. So we could focus on steroids, but no, there could be athlete X, Y, or Z that actually doesn't take steroids, but they could still take 27 other different avenues of performance-enhancing drugs. Hmm. So I just want to say that I don't want to make it sound even more sinister, but I like to be very fair, and that is the fair truth. Yeah. But anyway, on the point of steroids, we'll start with a very fundamental distinction. Then I'll go back and kind of give you a chronological overview. The distinction I want to make is testosterone, the male hormone that you, me, and every other male, and for that matter, in a very, very small amount, all of the females in the world actually make endogenously, we make ourselves, is not an anabolic steroid. It is a steroid for sure. Steroid is a word that connotates a class of hormones derived from cholesterol that, you know, the body makes and uses. It is a steroid. An anabolic steroid, by definition, were you to get a medical dictionary, look it up, which I recommend everyone does whenever confronted with a scary, sciencey word. Look it up. It's a great practice. And what you'll find is, by definition, an anabolic steroid is a synthetic derivative of testosterone. Okay. I bring this up for 2 points. One, because being different, they deserve different nomenclature and a different part of the conversation. And then secondly, when we go back and talk about it chronologically, it makes sense why one group was earlier than the other, is because one exists naturally and normally in living creatures. The other had to be derivated and made by man. So there's an important distinction there, if nothing else. Hmm. So with that vague definition in mind, testosterone is in a class of drugs called androgens. Again, I don't mean to be super condescending, but perhaps people don't know. In science, the language of science is largely Latin, and scientists go pretty far out of their way to name a thing pretty close to what it is or what it describes. So were you to grab a Latin dictionary, look up androgen, you would find that it says that which makes male. And that is exactly what testosterone's job is. It turns small, you know, endogenous templates of humans into grown adult males. It is the hormone that which makes male. So that is the fundamental aspect of what this root hormone does. Then synthetic derivatives thereof, what they did, what they, being a blanket, the medical science community and organic chemists, tried to extract or accentuate specific characteristics within that maleness. For instance, perhaps just the muscle growth, or perhaps just some sort of reproductive action, or perhaps just aggression. There's many characteristics in that big blanket of maleness. We all know men are multifaceted asses, and there's lots of different things you could extract from that. So chemists took it on themselves to try and do that. So you have that root original hormone and then the derivatives thereof. Now, to go back and kind of give you a historical overview on this, this is where it's really going to cause a little bit of butthurt among the casual listener. There's a very big belief that steroids and hormone manipulation in sports is a new thing. It's a product of, and depending on who you ask, you'll get a different number. You know, the 1980s, the 1990s, didn't really happen until recently, whatever. The reality is, the concept of a male-generating substance was already in the wind, in the ether, in the times of the ancient Greeks. Even the Greeks understood that there was something in the blood that made men one way, women another. Certainly had no chemistry or science enough to identify it, but the conceptual idea was there already. So once the science started to become available, this was already in the air. People were already looking for it because they expected it, because it was relatively commonly acknowledged, which is bad practice, but in this case, it turned out to be, in fact, true. Now, a quirk that I'm going to tie into the historical concept of steroids is most great scientific discoveries come on the heels of an actual diagnostic tool. For instance, Galileo didn't discover the moons of Jupiter. He would not have been able to do that without the concept of the telescope. So even though the idea of planetary motion and all this stuff was already cooking in the wind, no one could identify it until they could actually dial in on it, see it. Same thing in biology, very, very much so in biology. And in this case, what happened is in the middle 1800s, in the midst of the Industrial Revolution, medical diagnostic tools started to become available. And one of them was the laboratory centrifuge, which is really just a little spinning Ferris wheel. You put test tubes in it and it'll spin around, and via centrifugal force at different velocities, different things will distill out of the liquids. So this device was developed. And every gentleman scientist the world around in the civilized world needed to have one, and then spun everything from literally, and when I say everything, I mean everything, from pond water to rainwater to milk to semen. If it was a liquid, there was some gentleman scientist putting in his laboratory centrifugation, spinning the hell out of it. And a lot of scientific discoveries came in that wave. Just all sorts of things were discovered. You know, globulin proteins in milk, parameciums in pond water, just all sorts of stuff. And one group of scientists, and one guy specifically, a German chemist in New York City, had a fetish for spinning, of all things, dog urine. And if you spin a volume of dog urine at a given speed, a yellow waxy crystal will precipitate out of it. Turns out, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, that is testosterone. Again, it wasn't understood the structure, any of that, but it was determined that that was the male thing. And the way in which they determined that is, in the early days of science, there wasn't a lot of ways to determine what something did other than apply it. So spin the urine, get the crystal, rinse it, dissolve it in water, and inject it back into the dog and see what happens. And with that particular crystal, what happens is the dogs got aggressive, they went into heat, and they gained body weight. Sounds familiar, folks. That, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, that there was testosterone. And literally from that point on, and that point in time is somewhere in the 1860s, the actual starting to apply it to animals was like the 1880s. Literally, no exaggeration, by the turn of the 20th century, testosterone was identified and the race was on to actually create it synthetically in the laboratory, which didn't happen, I believe, until 1928. But moral of the story is that's your timeline. Basically, anything post 20th century, turn of the 20th century, quote, steroids in the general vernacular being testosterone were available. They were a thing. Obviously not widely spread, obviously a very niche and clever thing, but did in fact exist. And then from there, the push was on to commercially reproduce this, be able to make it in mass, all of that. Again, just clever little moments in time. Testosterone suspension was first put on the market in 1925 as an actual saleable commercial product. Testosterone propionate was on the market by 1929 or 30. There's actually some argument on the date, but let's go with 1930. Interesting note, a name and a subject is kind of scary to bring up, but it's well known in history books that Adolf Hitler was monotesticular and literally had one of the earliest prescriptions for testosterone propionate. Potentially could play into the bad disposition. Don't know. But nonetheless, so that's kind of your timeline. Testosterone was a real thing by the 1930s. And I mean, when I say real, I mean real as in accessible, usable, applicable, real thing. So any sports number or figure from that point on has to be suspect, at least in contextual terms. I'm certainly not throwing anybody under the bus and go, oh, fuck, Mickey Mantle took steroids, or, you know, Babe Ruth, or any other name that people want to, deify. But I'm simply saying that you cannot argue against simply because the timing is now in place. Synthetic steroids started to come on the market. Well, actually, that's a lie. Won't say the market. Synthetic steroids started to be talked about in literature in the 1940s. And by the very early 1950s, you were seeing actual derivated anabolic steroids, the first of which was a product called Android F, which was nothing but testosterone with a giant ugly methyl group stuck on it. From there, a steroid, if people know drug names, halotestin. It's a testosterone with a chlorine group and some other stuff on it was becoming available. The infamous and ultimately game-changing Dianabol was an American copy, mind you, of an Eastern European drug that hit the market in 1960. So somewhere in the late 50s, early 60s, the world changed, the game changed, and actual synthetic, and actually one of the other key things was orally active anabolic steroids. And from that moment forward, we had drugs in sports. One quirky thing about this whole story is most drugs you could find were developed for a given purpose and then applied to something else. Very few drugs were created in large and financed in large for a niche thing. Steroids happened to be one of them. Anabolic steroids were largely funded and driven actually before athletic excellence. There was an understanding that they would have applications in actual clinical medicine. They were prescribed early on for geriatric osteoporosis, geriatric wasting, sarcopenia, all sorts of things. But the reality is the original funding was actually to win Olympic gold medals. There's a whole complicated story there, a guy named Dr. Carl Ziegler, who was independent of a major drug company, but later sold all his thoughts and ideas to SIBA Pharmaceuticals. And anabolic steroids were largely developed as an athletic tool with the side note connotation that, and they might help a couple of sick people. And that's roughly a very super capsule view of how steroids got to be what they are and how we got to where we are.
Yeah. And that's probably a really good point with the whole how they came about thing. Cause from the 60s through to the 80s, it was obviously the whole Cold War was playing out on the athletics track, and the Absolutely. Soviets versus the Americans, it was how they actually tried to express their superiority as a society in a lot of ways. And what I didn't realize for a long time, but gradually came to realize through reading about different scandals and whatnot, was that it was essentially a free-for-all during that period of 1960 to 1980-ish. And it wasn't until about that point that some of the different sporting federations and Olympic committees started you know, at a very, very surface level as a veneer to say, hey, we've got a problem here, we're going to do something about it. But it was largely a free-for-all up until that point.
Well, I wouldn't even say largely. I would say absolutely and unadulterated, almost to the point of being rather in the forefront. Two great Olympic lifters, Vasily Alexia of the Soviet Union and the American Ken Patera, actually joked publicly on television that the coming Olympic Games, I think the first reference would have been 76, but then later in 1980, they both publicly joked that the contest would be to find out whose steroids would reign supreme. Like, literally, they weren't even talking about their personal athletic acumen. They were actually referencing the pharmacopoeia, the drug programs of the respective nations. And that's a real thing. You can find reference to that in, you know, in public view. So that's how far it was, really, at that point.
Yeah. It was all on. It's probably worth reiterating, though, that, you know, for the uninitiated here, if you've got no athletic ability and you take steroids, you're still going to have no athletic ability.
Absolutely. And that's something that I would point out, you know, at some point in this conversation. I often reference personally, it's a little off topic, but yet not. So I'm going to go. I often reference steroid use to race cars, partly because I'm in America and everyone's a car nut. Everyone, you know, you're the people's grandmothers are car fanatics and enthusiasts in this country. And my point is this, is no matter the caliber of the automobile, if you lack sufficient driving prowess, you're almost certainly not going to win races, and you're almost certainly going to put yourself and the machine in peril. It really is a progression where, as your skill develops, the performance of your automobile should escalate with you. And that's really how steroids, or I say ought to, as if they ought to be part of sports, but if they were part of sports, that should be the progression. You develop a body of skill, and you slowly, your skill and your physical abilities, you know, come together to meet a culmination of athletic excellence. Just jumping into a race car with no driver's license is going to end in folly. It just is. And that's, I think, what you're alluding to there is you have to have the abilities to be able to apply that sort of horsepower, if you will.
Yeah. And obviously, as a society, especially the people in our society who are sports fans, there's this funny hypocrisy of our sports fans and our media demanding this level of performance from the athletes that we all look up to and we all worship. Yet when they do fail a drug test, it's like, how could you do this to us? You know, right. we have this funny thing going on. And when you start to understand what's actually happening behind the scenes, and you know as much as what you and I do, it's a hard one to swallow, because people talk about honesty and integrity and all this shit. But the reality is that these athletes, if they don't take it, for a large part, they ain't going to make it.
Absolutely. And that's the one fundamental point that I don't think the average, and I'll say American because I'm surrounded by them, but I think the average Western world person, the globe around, is there's kind of these water cooler conversations where they just like, I don't understand why these athletes just don't, you know, do it the hard way. And the truth is, the level of sports that the public expects today, there is no hard way. There's no way to do that. It's so far beyond the human genome that people, humans, are not capable in any way, shape, or form of putting 500 pounds above their head or running 100 meters in 9 fucking seconds. This stuff is not within our physical capabilities. It's literally why we develop fucking machinery. It's why, you know, we have humans now lifting loads that require trucks. It's not stuff that is humanly possible. And I say that as an athlete. I know what athletes are capable of. Been one my whole life, worked with thousands, and I know what human performance looks like, and I know what drug-driven human performance looks like, and they don't look very similar.
Yeah, and it's not a moral judgment. This is just an objective assessment. When you know how the organism works, as you do, being a biologist and being a strength and conditioning expert, yeah, it's just, you know, you can't do that unless you're doing this.
Yeah. And again, you know, and I point this out to people all the time, and, you know, I understand the arguments that, you know, more people are involved in weightlifting than ever were in the past, and you know, there's more food, and therefore people are, there's a lot of arguments, but it's not a coincidence that in the 1800s, zero people bench pressed 400 pounds. In the early 1900s, a handful of people bench pressed 400 pounds. 1970s, the number moved to 500 pounds. The 1980s, the weight moved to 600 pounds. There's a reason for that. It's because pharmacology became more accessible and better understood. No drugs equals no 400 pound bench presses. Yeah. Drugs equals 400 and above pound bench presses. Now, in today's world with, you know, food has reshaped the globe and we have, you know, people are much better fed and things. An actual 400 pound bench press without drugs is in fact possible. Still fucking rare. I mean, a real live drugless 400 pound bench press is a really rare thing, but it is possible. It's the 10 second 100 meter. It can be done. Going faster is hard, like impossible. And that's where we're at. And, you know, so when you see these numbers, you know, you see, you know, 100 kilogram Chinese people, you know, putting 250, 260 kilograms over their head. No, it's just, I'm not picking on them specifically. They're just the ones winning the medals right now. But my point is no humans are doing that without drugs. It doesn't happen. Yeah. Never did.
So let's talk briefly about the physiological changes that using some of these drugs can make.
Sure. Well, the best way to conceptualize it, if you have no real sports acumen, is think of the magnitude and diversity of changes from a 10-year-old blank little template of a boy to a 20-year-old man. Think about the enormous width and birth of change that took place in that. That's basically what you're talking about. The amount of, quote, steroids physically, you know, endogenously applied to turn that boy into that man will then use 25 times that to turn into that sports superhero that you're familiar with. And that's roughly the width and birth of the change. You're talking about changes on every level. Obviously, the creature, well, not obviously, but I will say specifically, most of the growth is no longer morphological. The subjects are not getting bigger, taller. You know, they're not getting bigger hands, bigger feet, bigger, although there are some quirky little possibilities where that can happen, but they're nominal. So by and large, we're talking about changes of soft tissue. We're talking about muscle remodeling, connective tissue, that sort of thing, bone density. So you're talking about vastly bigger muscles. We could talk about the internal changes and what that constitutes, because it is important and it does have very specifically permanent changes. Literally, you could do drugs and then never do drugs again, but you're never actually the same person again. And we could talk a little bit about that at a separate point in the conversation. But also, the talk about the changes drugs bring are, in my mind, threefold importance. One is psychological. Think about the timid, soft, androgynous attitude of a 10-year-old, and then think of the forward, brash, owning the world attitude of a 20-year-old man. They're pretty different. That's the kind of changes emotionally and psychologically that steroids bring. They're going to simply give you much greater belief in yourselves. Well-being is probably a very timid word for what I'm talking about, but just find any male that actually very unfortunately suffers from low T, you know, low testosterone, and then got some therapy to be medically be helped. They'll literally tell you they're a different person. Night and day, changed their life, everything's better, sun is brighter, you know, food tastes better, everything's better. Well, now multiply that by 1,000. That's how I feel every day. Life is fucking good. So those are the kinds of, you know, changes. So you set that at the top. Now, you're on top of the world. You own the world. You feel great. So training's a no-brainer. You're going to do it. You know, this whole idea, you know, all these little, you know, little people that suffer, you know, pre-workouts and stuff. My pre-workout? I get the fuck out of bed. I put some shoes on. That's my pre-workout. I'm ready to roll. Like, seriously, my life revolves around getting shit done, getting erections, and eating red meat. Like, that's kind of the attitude I'm talking about. So you've got that in place. Then you move down, and we're talking about drugs that raise your total work capacity. You can do more work per unit time with less repercussions. So you feel great. You have nearly unlimited capacity to do shit, whatever your shit is, whether it's lifting weights, kicking a football, you know, swinging a golf club, whatever it is, you can do a bunch more of that with much less repercussions. And then lastly, every action you take generates more results. So now seriously, take a moment and think about that chain of events. You feel amazing, you can perform like Superman, and you get double or triple the benefits from doing it. Well, if you follow that along, it's not going to take you long to realize, wow, these people are ahead. They've got an advantage. They're on to something. There you are.
Mate, sign me up.
Again, I shouldn't be proud of it, but I'm honest about it. I'm 46 years old. I've been using performance-enhancing drugs for 30 years. Which might come back into the conversation later about just how bad are they for you. But
well, let's go straight onto that, because that was a very compelling sales pitch that you gave me, and I'm ready to go. But I think now, in all fairness, let's talk about the downsides.
Well, sure. I'm embarrassed to say my memory is failing me, but there's a famous quote from a Greek, one of the famous Greeks, that dosage determines the poison. Hmm. And the connotation is anything that's good for you can be poisonous if consumed in excess. Water is important. Too much water, you fucking drown, etc. So dosage determines the poison. And again, think about somebody with low T. They get some testosterone therapy. Their life becomes better, not worse, better. So the idea that they're inherently just negative, not so. Again, without steroids on some level, everyone would remain a 10-year-old boy, and that's probably not the appropriate answer, big picture. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that more is better and, you know, I'm right and everyone else is wrong. I get it. However, I just want to make that distinction that we're not talking about something like uranium, where any amount is really pretty fucking bad and it should never be around people. It's not what we've got here. There are medical situations where some is very good, very beneficial, very helpful. And then moving forward from there, the problem becomes this. And I will talk about some very specific, these are bad consequences. But between here and there is a very gray area. For instance, it's pretty well established that the average resting testosterone of a male the turn of the 21st century was literally about half of what it was in the turn of the 20th century. So over the course of 100 years, plasma resting testosterone levels declined about by half. Now, there's a lot of reasons people love to jump on, oh, it's environmental toxins, it's soy, it's, you know, Teletubbies, it's whatever they want to fucking blame it on. The reality is most of that is just a change in lifestyle. Life is not as hard as once was. People don't work with their hands at the level they once did. There's a lot of actual environmental changes in terms of how behavioral changes that precipitated that. But my point is this. That means on a genetic level, our tolerance for these things is actually much higher than it presently is as a society as a whole. So from a physiological point of view, there's obviously a pretty big margin of tolerance. Now, obviously, athletes are way outside of that normal range of tolerance, but I do want to build some perspective and not make it seem like, you know, if some 35, 40-year-old man takes a shot of testosterone, you know, he's going to get cancer, he's going to, you know, get erectile dysfunction. Not true at all. Okay. Now, as you move up the scale, just like the analogy of talking about race cars, the faster the car goes, quite obviously, the more dangerous the accidents can get. Like, you know, having a crash at 20 miles an hour is not nearly the same as 120 miles an hour, and certainly nothing like 200 miles an hour. Well, athletes are up in that 200 mile an hour category. They're doing a lot of this stuff and putting themselves at greater risks. Those risks specifically would be things like above normal hormone levels, male hormones, androgens, has a significantly negative impact on blood lipid profile, cholesterol, LDL, HDL ratio, even blood viscosity. So there's a distinct immediate tilt toward the not so good for your cardiovascular system, okay? Maybe on the same level as bacon, but nonetheless, you know, it's kind of bad, especially in a case like myself where it's protracted over 30 years. Probably not bad for a 4 or 5, maybe even 10-year, you know, athletic career. But when you take it on as a career, that's a significant downside. Elevations in blood pressure, probably one of the more insidious things that face people of elevated body weight. And you're talking about drugs that make you more muscular, bigger, stronger. So your body weight's going up. So you're walking around all the time with the potential for low-grade hypertension. And that, again, protracted over a lifetime, very bad. And lastly, well, not lastly, I'll do lastly, truly lastly. There's a million things in the middle. There are incidences of, you know, arterial sclerosis, atherosclerosis, cardiorespiratory problems of all kinds. And the problem with those things is there's not a drug out there that doesn't generate those aberrant problems. People have unfortunately died from Tylenol. There's problems. Yes, there's been a few cases of liver tumors and this and that. But unfortunately, there's also people that get that shit for no good goddamn reason whatsoever. So I won't dwell on that, but I won't say that it doesn't happen. I mean, grab any insert from any prescription medicine, and you'll read some horrifically absurd, you know, side effects. Like, you know, it's a you know, a simple drug for erectile dysfunction, but unfortunately, one poor guy, you know, died from constipation or some whatever, and it has to be printed on that little thing. So definitely there's some weird shit out there. But in general, like I said, the cardiovascular issues, blood pressure issues, and then the last one that really slips people's mind is the number one indicator of mortality across all species is mass. Bigger animals of the same species. You know, if you were talking about dogs, little tiny dog, great big dog never lives as long as little dog. It's mass is the number one indicator of mortality within the species curve. So if you're taking a group of drugs that by definition are going to make you bigger and stronger, keyword bigger, you are almost certainly putting some pressure on your mortality. Big people tend not to live as long as small people. So the number one probably major insidious unspoken negative is it makes people bigger, and that's bad.
What if some of those issues there, the cardiovascular risk and the blood pressure and whatnot, are they negated to a certain degree if you are following a more rounded fitness regime versus that of a power lifter?
I would not say it negated, but I would certainly say tempered by.
Yeah.
I would certainly say that. Just like, you know, I think we can all agree that modern society has some negatives. There's environmental pollutants. There's stuff. There's, you know, there's, as good as this life is, there's some negative pressures. But on the other side of the coin, you know, eating green vegetables, getting a little exercise, sleeping at night, roughly balances it out, and all told, you're to the good. You know, it's better than life was 100 or 2 or 3 or 500 years ago. So no matter where there's negatives, there's always positives. The key is some semblance of balance, and that's where things tend to be lost on the mindset and attitude of people that become high-level athletes. Is it, by definition, it is not a balanced environment, you know?
Yeah, and this is probably for the average listener out there, in giving it some context, there a lot of people and the uninitiated are probably looking at steroid use or the use of anabolics, and all they see in their head is an image of Rich Piana or some crazy huge bodybuilder, you know, that's 130 kilos and massive and dies in his 50s or his 40s. But there is also that whole other side, the therapeutic side. You know, if you're a 30 to 40 year old male and you've got low testosterone levels, your life is going to be pretty shitty. But if you can find a doctor who specializes in this, does all the blood tests and administers you therapeutic amounts of testosterone or whatever it may be, the net positive is there. It's going to outweigh the negatives.
Absolutely. Just the counterbalance of the depression is life-changing. I mean, literally, I said that before, and I'm not exaggerating. It truly is. And just like you said about, you know, the kind of the therapeutics and a doctor and blood tests, again, there's where some of the problems come in. It's because, again, using the analogy of a race car, if you have, you know, $100,000 high-performance race car, chances are you get diagnostics done on it regularly. You take it out, run it like hell, and then you drop it off at the shop. And that guy puts some clever gauges and shit on it and checks stuff that I don't understand. That's unfortunately not how people treat themselves. Ideally, you would treat yourself with the same respect you treat a possession. And as you do this, you would also swing by the shop and get some diagnostics and get blood work on a regular basis and those sorts of things. So though you know you're putting negative pressures on your health, you can actually have a documentation of how much, what kind, to what consequence. And with behavior like that, the risks suddenly go down precipitously simply because you are now engaged in the action. You are part of the process. You're not just randomly, you know, oh, drugs work, so I'll take them. There might be a little more to it than that. There, or at least there should be.
Yeah, I think it might have been on our friend in common, Rawdon Dubois' podcast. He had Dr. Mike Scully, I think, was on there, and he's a testosterone replacement therapy advocate and a doctor that specialized in that area. And he said, you know, everyone always wants to bring up the enlarged prostate argument against testosterone supplementation for men. And he said, here's the thing. Most of these men, well, all of these men who are getting an enlarged prostate as they age, they already have low testosterone levels. Most of them are also losing muscle mass. Most of them are carrying too much body fat. So the whole argument for not giving it to men as they age is kind of redundant. He said, you know, the prostate is enlarging anyway. And what we can do is we can start to negate some of those other health issues and help these men feel good about the days they have left on this earth. And there should be many days, but let's actually enjoy them. And he talked about the very, very powerful effects testosterone can have for combating depression. And he said he's far more comfortable prescribing that than he is for prescribing SSRI drugs or any of the conventional drugs that are used for treating mental illness.
Absolutely. I wouldn't even begin to question that. I agree with it entirely. And I will also point out, when I talked about, you know, drugs originally starting in sports and then kind of moving secondarily into clinical medicine, one of the reasons for the width and birth of a variety of steroids that are available, anabolic steroids that are available, is in that 1950s to 1970s window when science was actually actively engaged in creating them, one of the goals was to minimize, be able to create an anabolic compound to fight, you know, wasting and sarcopenia and geriatrics and all those things we talked about, and yet minimize things like prostate development. So we have specifically drugs, I'll just throw out a name, we have drugs like Primobolan specifically for that purpose, to develop and maintain muscle mass without antagonizing prostate development or left ventricular hypertrophy or some of these other things. So the reality is, science kind of started down that road, and then because of very negative backlash from the public, being a couple of shitty legislators, but the public, you know, drug companies felt less compelled to spend their money in that avenue. And so research basically stopped circa 1970. If science had continued on the path it was, we, science at large and even athletes, would have very effective, very safe drugs, just like And it seems completely out of context, but it's not. Just like birth control. Early birth control for females was horrible stuff. I mean, just wretched, bad for you. I mean, barely worth the trade-off. But from 1950 to 2000, birth control is now pretty streamlined science, pretty sensible, pretty safe, you know, very effective. Imagine that same chain of events on the masculine side. You know, we would have once, you know, swing by once a month, get your shot, feel like $1 million, you know, maintain all your muscle, keep all the hair on your head, big smile. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way, but the potential is there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an interesting point, that the birth control pill, certainly as good as it is, still has just as many downsides as using anabolic steroids. So
probably so.
Just a very different view. Where is this view come from, though? Why have we attached this perception of criminality to a hormone that is naturally occurring in the body and derivatives of?
Do you want my supposition? Because I have no firm answer for it.
I like your suppositions, mate. Let's go.
My supposition is annoying liberal floppy dick Christians like Joe Biden, our former vice president. Joe Biden thought he was semi-athletic in the height of his youth, and he couldn't nail a cheerleader, and therefore steroids are bad, and nobody can ever fuck a cheerleader again, ever. And that's literally how we got to where we are. I know that's very childish and blanket, but if you hear that ass of a man speak, that's basically what he says. He couldn't fuck a cheerleader, so nobody should. Steroids are illegal forever.
Yeah, I think I'll make that the headline of this episode.
That's you know, I know that's very off color and mean to say, but that's, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the guy's a criminal. You know, and the way he treated that. He let his personal patheticness become national and later global legislation. Just, you know, because I don't know. I have such disdain for it. I can't even put it into words. And I'm reasonably.
It's that whole archetype of a legislator has got to legislate, you know? So it's like, fuck, there's something we can make a rule against. And don't worry that we're then going to have these unrealistic expectations of our athletes. And we're going to have this totally hypocritical view and narrative around it. We're going to do it anyway.
Yep, and that's basically what it is. I mean, if you follow the legislative history of drugs in this country, when the Anabolic Steroid Control Act of 1990 was put forward, most people went, wow, that doesn't seem right. And it was actually put in front of, and I'm using American terms, so it may not exactly interpret, but it was put in front of the FDA, the DEA, and the AMA, which is basically the alphabet soup of people that are important to drugs. And every single one of those groups put forward the idea that legislation was much too bold and controlling of that class of substances and not realistic to the threat posed. And yet, almost exclusively and single-handedly, Joe Biden forced that legislation into law, simply because he personally was butthurt because he thought the people fucking all the cheerleaders were taking steroids.
Yeah. Sorry.
And we were, but that's separate. That's a separate thing.
That's right. That's right. It's a whole different issue. Now, obviously, wherever the rulemakers try to stop people from doing something to get an advantage, there's a workaround and there's another way.
Almost unreal to do so.
What's that?
I said there's almost an unrealistic and unnatural motivation to do so. A lot of people simply cheat because they fucking want to.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of like, how dare you tell me I can't do something? I'm going to do it.
That's it. That's actually how one goes down the path of evil genius. Is that part right there? Is, don't tell me I can't do this. I'll fucking figure out how to do it.
So what are some of the alleged and rumored developments in the world of performance enhancing drugs in athletics? What's some of the stuff you've heard is going on now that's well advanced past the narrative?
Well, I can, I can lead you through like even things I've been part of, much less things I've heard. The I've heard part is even more extraordinary and science fiction like, but things that are going on, this is fact, things that are going on. You have athletes like Tour de France athletes, that sort of thing, using cancer drugs that actually create additional blood volume. So they actually have more blood within their circulatory system, which can carry more oxygen, which lets them ride up the side of fucking mountains at 50 miles an hour, which is completely impossible without drugs, by the way. that's really happening. Things that are also happening is in that same mindset, athletes are withdrawing units of blood, putting it in cold storage, and then just before events, actually introducing it back into their body. So they have that same additional blood volume, greater plasma, greater red blood cell count. They're doing it a different way. That method is also used to beat drug tests. Basically, it's called the oil change. Athletes are just withdrawing blood when they're not taking drugs, putting it on ice. And then when they are taking drugs, remove blood, introduce blood that's not drug tainted. That's really happening. Same thing's happening with urine. Athletes are storing urine and then actually cathizing themselves, emptying their bladder, introducing untainted urine into their bladder, and then quick running to give the quick pee test before they pop like a balloon. That's happening. Steroids, of course, are happening. And then from that, you have something that most people kind of blanketly drop into the steroid category, but you have growth hormone, insulin, IGF-1, an assortment of peptides that your listeners probably haven't heard of, but trust me, they're out there. And each one of those drugs has a specific influence on a specific tissue or action within the body. Amphetamines are huge in sports. Painkillers are giant in sports. Painkillers actually crop up in places you would never expect them to. For instance, TV actors, models, Miss America, you know, pageantry. Painkillers are very highly used because those are very diet intensive fields. Well, it turns out you don't know you're hungry if you're stoned. So that's certainly happening. A lot of high level bodybuilders wind up with opioid addictions for that very reason. You just don't know how hungry you are if you're stoned all the time. And also, you don't really know how bad your joints and parts hurt from hours and hours of training. So that's a real thing. There are drugs specifically applied to the brain to create aggression for fighters, for even gymnasts, that sort of thing. There's drugs, speaking of gymnasts, there's drugs specifically that influence flexibility, joint mobility. So the pantheon of drugs that can be used, enormous. Then from there, the big, whispers is the idea of gene therapy. Well, boys and girls, that's really happening. We're not at the point where it's being done in the test tube, you know, where babies are literally like the movie Twins while babies are cooked up and, then presented. We're not there yet, but I can tell you some things that are happening. Rumor has it, Jamaica's the place this is going on. But there were a number of science papers put out in the early 2000s about some very specialized skin cells that humans have. They're not understood very well. They're basically blank cells. They don't seem to do anything. But they have all the constituents of normal, healthy cells. They just kind of take up space. And there's a thought that either they're on their way toward evolving into something or maybe on their way evolving away from something. Because mammals do share common dermal tissue with a lot of sub-creatures. What we have as hair on our arms is the same genetic structure that would make quills in certain kinds of animals, and in prehistory would have made scales. So that whole the structures are very similar. So there's this thought that maybe this is a migration to or toward or away from something. But anyway, the moral of the story is there was some speculation, very detailed speculation, that maybe you could specifically breed some viruses or germs that could carry genetic information into these blank cells and convince them to do something. And as far-fetched as that sounds, it's not very different than how we manufacture insulin and growth hormone in modern medicine today. Something called genetic recombinant technology. We tweak E. coli bacteria, actually, is the one that's used in this case. We genetically tweak E. coli bacteria and feed them food, and their waste product is literally human insulin. We clean it, package it, sell it to millions of happy diabetics. So the idea was we could use that same technology on skin cells to get them to do something. And very shortly after that paper was published, the whole subject got incredibly quiet. Nobody talked about it. And very soon thereafter, there were some aberrant things happening in the world of sports. And the reality is that technology was bought, paid for, put underground, and we have this technology being applied to athletes today. As I said, Jamaica is the place that comes up in the conversation, and I don't find it a coincidence that we have some very aberrant and exceptional athletes coming out of that very small, low population corner of the world. Also, Argentina comes up in that conversation also. Argentina, they actually have some quirky laws, or actually don't have some quirky laws, restricting stuff like stem cell technology, that sort of thing. So there is a lot of push for genetic recombinant type technology in Argentina. So that wouldn't be surprising simply because they're actually allowed to do it. But those are some things that are actually happening. And then from there, there's speculation of even more absurd things happening. The most absurd I've heard of, or I've heard speculation of, is that takes a little understanding of engineering, but the length, the amount of muscle you have is relevant to how strong you are, but also is the physics of where the actual muscle connects to the bone. You know, kind of like a lever. If you make a lever longer, you change the mechanics of how much weight it can lift, that sort of thing. So there is this speculation with the very modern and surgery techniques that it is actually possible to unattach a muscle, move its attachment, reattach it to a bone. Now you have the same muscle, no drugs, but you have exaggerated leverages. So now you could do superhuman things because you have superhuman physics on your side.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So, I don't think that's that outrageous. I think that's the sort of thing that athletes would pursue. I mean, it's not much different than going out of your way to buying or making specialized shoes to change your leverage when you squat. Mm-hmm. Just instead of changing the shoes, you're now changing the actual dynamics of your muscular leverage, but not outside of the realms of belief by any stretch.
Mate, absolutely fascinating information. I think today you've painted a really interesting insight for my listeners, whether they be somewhat knowledgeable on this matter or total novices. You've given a great insight into it not just being a black and white topic. Absolutely. You know, there's pros and cons, and also probably shattered a few perceptions that people have of their favorite athletes throughout history. Because probably. Really, you know, you and I both know that the truth is that, we don't judge, but we know the truth is that professional sport is not clean. So,
no, and that's, you know, again, if I can just interject a little bit here, is, you know, steroids get all the news again because of that demonization by a couple of really crappy legislators. But drugs in sports at large is a very old topic. The first official death, and that's official, mind you, the first official death in sports associated with drugs was in the 1800s. Not the Tour de France, but an actual European cycling race. There were a number of athletes using a combination of speed and heroin, and there was deaths associated with it. So the idea of drugs in sports is essentially as old as sports.
Mm. Yeah.
So
I don't doubt it. Mate, thank you so much for your time. It's been a really good insight. Now, you've got a tour to Australia coming up. So for those who are listening from this side of the world, when is that happening?
That is rapidly approaching and quite honestly frightening the hell out of me. Not the concept of Australia. I'm really excited to see and meet all of you in your land, but the idea of getting me out of my comfort zone and squeeze onto an aeroplane, and I think it takes like, what, 9 days or something to get there. It's The whole concept's really frightening. Yeah. But the moral of the story is April 7th and 14th, respectively, be in Sydney and Brisbane.
Great. All right. And in the meantime, people can follow your work on Facebook and Instagram, Team Evil GSP.
That is correct. All of my social media, what have yous, are at Team Evil GSP. So if I'm on a given social modality, that's how you would find me.
Excellent. All right, mate. Thanks again for your time today. That was an amazing insight. Who knows? Maybe we'll get you back on the show another time to talk about something equally as sinister or maybe just a little bit more mainstream. Who knows?
Anything you like. We could be more specific, more general, or talk about something entirely different, although I'm a pretty limited creature, so I don't know what that would be. But you're a good host. You might be able to pull something out of me.
All right. Thanks, Broderick.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.